Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 186 on the land entitlement process for multifamily development with Reed Goossens. If you're into building wealth through real estate investing, you are in the right place. My goal is to identify high-caliber real estate investors and other industry service providers, invite them on the show, and then draw out the jewels of wisdom, those tactics, mindsets, and methods used to create millions of dollars and more in the business of real estate. Reed is a returning guest of the show, joining us first back in 2018 on the eve of his $9.5 million capital raise for a deal with a $10 million projected profit. So we're going to get an update on how this deal is going during the episode. Reed's career started as an engineer, working around the world building large projects, including the infrastructure for the 2012 Olympics in London, among many others. So he and I are going to focus on this side of his skill set during the discussion today, to include the land entitlement process as it relates to multifamily deals. Ready to get started?
All right, cool. Welcome back to the REI Diamond Show. Reed Goossens, how are you doing today?
G'day, mate. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, for sure. So for context, for listeners who may not have been here back in 2018, you are a returning guest, and our topic was raising $9.5 million with a projected profit of over $10 million. And so I guess we'll start there with a little bit of an update of how that went. Did the deal close? And like, whereabouts are you in that deal, Reed?
Yeah. So you said 2018?
It was 18. Yeah, maybe.
Okay.
Maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to think, because I remember the deals by the equity raises.
Okay. So all right.
That would have been, I think, deal number three, and we're at deal number 12 now. So it's completely blown up, obviously, in a good way. That specific deal is going great. One thing I will probably, you know, just to look back on, if I could go back in time, would be don't do fixed rate interest rates because interest rates are now really low. Mm. We did back in 2000, I think it was early 2018, it would have been a 4.5-ish 10-year Treasury Freddie Mac loan. I should have got floating. So, lesson learned, but you make the decision in real time. And, for all those people out there, don't be afraid of the agency floaters, because they're good product. But I remember back at the time, I was sort of being newer into, only being three deals in, saying, for our investors, let's just cap it and let's just do a fixed rate for 10 years and get 5 years interest only, which was still a really good deal. But just looking at where interest rates are today, you're like, wow, I could be making a lot more cash flow. So, yeah.
Yeah, true enough. But does the interest rate fluctuation taken on now create a larger risk profile that I'm sure you had in mind when you were calculating risk on the previous deals? I mean, would that be the same wise move today, or locking in the low interest rate now, like how much lower can they go?
Exactly. 100%. Like if you can lock in at 3% today, yeah, for sure. Like definitely lock in and go for 10. That's 100%. It's just that I didn't, back then I thought interest rates were going higher. And so I think it was 4.35% or whatever it was, whatever we locked it in, I thought they were going to 6. I didn't think they'll be going back down to 3. So, hindsight 2020, you can only do what you can see in front of you right then and there. And we thought it was the best thing for the deal, and it still is the best thing for the deal. We've just executed on a $2.2 million supplemental loan on that deal, because it was a Freddie deal. You can go back and it kind of acts like a refi, but we went in with such low leverage that we went and got more money out of the deal to keep going with that capital expenditure. And it's 5 years interest only. So we're really happy where the deal is sitting today. And, we'll be in the portfolio for at least another 3 to 4 years. So still got some time on it.
Nice, nice. Yeah, I was listening to a multifamily investing podcast the other day, and one of the members that was, or the guest on the show, I can't remember which show it was, had 4,000 or 5,000 units. He sounded like he was probably in his late 60s or early 70s. So he had this, nice, solid multifamily career. And he was looking back, and he said that around the area now, from what he's hearing, you know, like the big names, Blackstone and these private equity Wall Street types, they're not afraid of the floating rates. They don't think that rate risk is going to be a realistic threat, certainly at any point in time in a 5, 7, or 10-year term that these, you know, big smart money investors are supposed to be doing business. So he kind of shared the same sentiment as you and just didn't view that as much of a risk. I mean, who knows who's right?
Exactly.
So, you know, 12 deals in, what is your exit strategy? You end up selling these at any point? Have you sold any of the deals that you've done, or are you still in hold periods on everything?
No, good question. So we started our first deals were in 2000, end of 2016, early 2017. I'd been involved in multifamily as a co-GP prior to that. So, you know, probably 2 or 3 years prior to that, early 2014, I got started, but I really started my own shop at the end of 2016. So I've been into the 8 years in the syndication space. And then in terms of your exit strategies, yes, we're actually coming to exit a couple of deals right now. And they're the deals that have the most flexibility on the debt, right? So the deal we just spoke about that I was speaking to you back previously in 2018, I can't exit that deal because I've got to have a big prepay, right? Unless someone wants to come and assume the deal. The deal isn't sucking wind by any means. It's making money for my investors, making cash flow. So just keep it. You know, we'll ride out the prepay. But we have another two sets of deals that we'll board as a portfolio, and we have to build bridge on those deals. And we've had them for about 2 years, 2.5 years now. And we are going to, we sort of popped our head up thinking, okay, we can refi here or we can sell. And we popped our head up and did a bit of an off-market type of shop around. And we got the number we wanted to hit, and you know, for this time period to give a pretty solid return for investors. And we decided to execute on the sale. If no one had taken bit at the number we wanted, then we would have gone for a refi. But you know, the opportunity to exit at multiple points along the deal is exactly what we assess every single day, well, not every single day, but you know, on a very consistent basis to understand where the market's at, and particularly with cap rates compressing as interest rates continue to go lower. That's you're seeing that shockwave across the country in terms of multifamily, particularly in our area of Central Texas. So yeah, we constantly look at what is the best opportunity to exit for deal for investors, and a little bit selfishly, we as a company, you know, myself, my business partner Andrew and I, you know, as we're growing to 12 and hopefully going to go double the portfolio in the next 3 to 5 years, people are starting to ask, where's your skins on the wall? Where are your runs on the board? And that's where you got to start pointing to cycle deals and how did it go? What was the returns? And we're really happy to say that we are finally coming to the first set of deals that are selling and got to make a nice, healthy little profit for all our investors involved.
Nice. I'm always curious. I do a lot of single family. And when I got into single family business in 2006, there was all mom and pop localized investors. And then 2008, 9, and 10 came, and we saw the Blackstones and Cerberus and a lot of these big funds put together a lot of money. You have Divvy Homes out here, and there's this trend toward institutionalization of single family homes. And these are typically kind of the scattershot, very difficult to manage, very difficult to roll up assets, single family, which is a lot of the reason that a lot of people will gravitate toward the larger 100, 200, 300,000 unit apartment complexes. So I'm curious, is the same trend occurring in multifamily where perhaps the buyers for your stabilized asset at this new profit level, I mean, are these institutional buyers or are these entrepreneurial funded buyers just like yourself, who it's, you know, 4, 5, 6 partners cobbled together a team and then put together 12 or hopefully 24 deals in the course of the next 3 to 5 years? Who are the buyers, basically?
Yeah, good question. So I think to answer that question, you have to also look at what you just said, the historical trend of institutional Wall Street money looking at real estate as an alternative asset. I wholeheartedly believe, and I do a lot of these podcasts, that real estate, it ain't an alternative asset anymore. And part of the reason, particularly in commercial, you're seeing a lot of this compression in the cap rate because it is a physical asset. You do have the scalability of it in terms of buying 1,000 units, and you don't have to have 1,000 different individual roofs or 1,000 different individual foundations that you got to deal with in the single family space, which is what Blackstone and BlackRock and Blackfish and whoever, Black something else, whatever, you know, that, what those guys probably saw in back in 2008, 2009 was that management piece was really, really tough. But in the commercial side, multifamily, as we've continued to be a nation of renters, as the, you know, wage increases are pretty much remaining stagnant, as affordability continues to go up and continues to become an issue, multifamily is still a really, really attractive vehicle for living and also for investing, even with compressing cap rates. So I do think a lot of institutional dollars in the last 8 to 10 years have started to really, really be big players in the game. To answer your question of the buy-in pool, yeah, we're actually selling to a group that is more entrepreneurial like we are, because we have actually left meat on the bone. We're only 2.5 years into our business plan, and we have the flexibility of selling right now. We've only done 30% of the units, but we've completely done the exterior. We've done the leasing center. We've done the clubhouse. We've done the gardens. We've rebranded it. We've done the whole heavy lift, but we've only done 30% of the units. So there's still more meat there that someone else can come along and execute, right? And for us as a seller, we can sell a value add with meat on the bone at a lower cap rate than I can sell it as a stabilized deal if I'd done 100% of the units. So for us, we're getting a better bang for our buck by selling it with a bit of meat on the bone rather than going and trying to do with 100 units or the 100% of the units and then sell it at like a 5 cap or a 5.5 cap. So, yeah.
Gotcha. And would the institutional buyers, say, be a better fit of a buyer at the end when 100% of the units are updated? It's, stabilized A product with market rents versus any of this entrepreneurial having to finish the renovations. It's more passive for the institutional investor at that latter point, I think, right?
Yeah, look, the tricky little secret here is that after 5 to 7 years, it's a value add for anyone else who wants to come along.
Because
those original rehabs you've done, they're probably 7 years old now. They need a lift anyway. So, there's always going to be value add. To your point of institutions, they don't like to do a lot of hard work. So they're going to go and probably buy your more 2000 builds, 2010 builds. And that's what we're currently starting to look at now. We don't want to look at the 80s product anymore because it is really old. Not that we won't entertain it. It's just that we know from experience that there's a lot more skeletons in the closet. They're coming up to 40 years of age. They're just the bigger, I can buy, if I'm buying a 4.5 cap on an 80s product, or I can buy a 5 cap at a 2000 product, I'm going to buy a 2000 product. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
because absolutely. Even though it's more stabilized, I might not have as much meat on the bone. I have less risk, and I can, I can still make a really nice spread between where interest rates are and hold it for a little bit longer. So instead of a 5-year hold, maybe hold it for a 7 or 8 year hold and get a bit of that value add towards the tail end, because the units will then start to be old. But I'd rather do that than go and buy a 1980s asset, which had boiler systems and the old roofs and, issues that we are now seeing in, we spoke a little bit offline before we started recording, what's happening in Texas right now with the snow. So, these assets that are built, we've got some newer assets in our portfolio that are faring just fine, but the older assets that were built in the 80s aren't going so well. So it's all sort of swings and roundabouts. And for me, as we progress and we get old, we move further down the line, a thing that was built in 2000 or the late 90s is now going to be a value add for me as a buyer, and thus is going to be, I've got some meat left on the bone and somewhere some more juice to squeeze out of that rock.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm laughing because I have the single family thing, that's our space, and we see Atlanta specifically. We're in Atlanta, Chicago, and Philadelphia. Atlanta has the fund buyers, the Blackstones, this one, that one. They're buying there. They have that's almost the same kind of, it's not quite as new as you're describing where it's built in the 2000s, but stuff that's built in the 2000s, that's hot fund product. Stuff that's built in the 90s, still pretty hot fund product. Stuff in the 50s or 60s, some of the funds will touch it, but most of them have a buy box that has to fit. Or they take a pass. And I laugh because I buy small multifamily stuff for my own portfolio. And I bought an 8-unit building that's probably built in like 1920 or 1930. I'm thinking, man, it would be great to have something built in the 90s. And we did the roof last year. And the roof had, 6 to 8 inches worth of layers on top. They just kept going. And we had a lot of snow here, I think 45 inches in the Chicago market, literally. And I was thinking to myself, I am so happy that it was like a $60,000 roof. I'm happy I didn't cheap out on the roof and they could have put a layer over top. But the guy's like, look, man, this is going to get really heavy if there's snow. And literally, I mean, it's all over the news in Chicago that roofs are caving in on people left and right because you got, you know, 30
weight.
Yeah, exactly. But what we're seeing in Texas is blowing my mind. And so maybe you want to kind of touch on that. I'm sure everyone has seen it in the news. Frozen pipes. The region is just not engineered for the type of weather that has come through there. And you own and are bullish on the Texas market. And so you have this real boots on the ground, real world experience. Why don't you just talk about that for a few moments here, Reed?
And I want to also add that Texas as well is you don't find as many 1920s product like you do in, say, the Chicago's or the New York's or the Boston's, where these really historically older cities, you know, Texas is relatively, I want to say newer, but the large multifamily was, the boom was really in the 70s, right? 70s and 80s, that's when a lot of construction was down there, the garden style apartments. And to be honest, they were built okay, but they weren't built for snow. You know, they weren't built to weather, you know, they weren't weatherizing or winterizing, I should say, you know, pipes under the ground. They weren't digging 4 feet down to get below the frost line to build your pipes. So, you know, there's just little things like that that are just, and then on top of that, you've got an infrastructure system like, because I figured out that Texas is on its own grid, power grid. It's unlike the rest of the country. And that ain't weatherized either, winterized either. So that's causing a lot of issues. I know the newer build product we've got is faring better just because of the building codes have come up to speed. But the 1980s product isn't faring as well because of, one, the age, but two, the way they built it back in the day. So to answer your question, yeah, it's a little bit I'm flying down on Sunday to assess the damage. I've got a call here in 45 minutes to sort of go over what's happened. I think, touch on wood, our 2,500 units are going, you know, we've got a handful, 20 to 40 units that are going to be issues, but we'll get that in, you know, covered by insurance. But, you know, I've heard people, you know, whole buildings burned down because people had nowhere to warm themselves and they're starting fires in their living room. You know, like there's just dumb stuff like that. So hopefully we don't have any of that. I have heard the electricity's come back on at all our properties, which is good. Water's still a little bit of an issue in Austin. But, you know, I've heard people boiling snow. I've heard we had to hire a bus on one of our assets to just sit on site and so people could walk inside the bus and keep warm, you know, overnight because they were out power for nearly 5 days. So it's a little bit, you know, for someone living in Chicago or New York or Boston, you're laughing, right? But when you literally aren't set up for it and potentially, there's some blame on the state level that they should have done some more to weatherize their infrastructure. But until you're sort of living it, you can't really say, well, you know, hindsight 2020 again, you're like, oh, I should have done that. But maybe it will put them in, you know, the way people are built now moving forward will be completely different to how they were building over the last 20 or 30 years. So to answer your question, we're still sort of in the thick of it, but I think we'll get out of it okay. And you know, I'll see next week when I finally get boots on the ground.
Yeah, true enough. And I wonder how much you mentioned, like, the stuff in the 80s is not faring as well as the new build. And for context, for people who don't know, the 80s was kind of the Mike Milliken, you know, bond driven cheap market where money, you know, for certainly one of the earlier times in my own recent history became super cheap. Super easily available. And like whatever we saw in the 2000 to 2004 single family housing market, like that loose lending standard that we all remember, like that's what occurred during the 80s. So I can only imagine that there was some slipshod, hurry up, throw it up, get that refi and keep it moving. Like, yeesh, yeah, I don't think I want to touch any of the 80s product either. Huh?
Yeah. And then that's the difference, right? The standard of building in certain areas. And to your point, just bang it up. You know, if you ever go to a Texas multifamily, some of them are built in the hallways. They're not air conditioned or they're not conditioned spaces, and they keep them open to, you know, for the heat. But also now it's now come full circle with the winter. The hallways don't, you know, they're not closed off to the elements. So again, things that you think are suited for certain climates, but as you know, things change. It just like, well, that was dumb, wasn't it? We should have put doors on there. We should have conditioned the space.
Yeah, true enough. So, true enough. Yeah. So do you have a history or a background at all? I thought I saw somewhere on your profile that you were in hotel construction originally. Is that?
No, my background is in structural engineering. I built a lot of product across the globe. I worked in London on the 2012 Olympic Games back in 2008. I built stuff in New York. I built stuff in LA. I built stuff obviously in Australia. That's my background. So I do come at this with a different lens than the average investor, you know, understanding what things, the building codes and how to be compliant with building codes. And, you know, I mentioned the frost line before, like 4 feet below the ground in New York is like where you got to put your foundations because that's where the frost line is. So little things like that you pick up along the way. And then as you go from state to state, different climates, you notice things like, you know, when you're in Hawaii, you don't have the same type of construction as you do in Boston. You know what I mean? So it's just for the different climates. But as those climates change, yeah, you sort of think, oh, I should have built it a little bit different. It's too late. So
shoulda, woulda, coulda. Yeah. I'm always like, you know, it's like a whole nother layer to the Reed Goosen story to hear the structural engineering piece. And I look at like my own background, like one of my earliest tools, or I guess toys, was like tools. My dad was an electrician, mm-hmm. so I had like a screwdriver and a hammer and like wire strippers, and I would like wire up outlets for fun at like five or 6 years old. Not live electricity, but you know, growing up on the job site, the construction site, I had about a year and a half of mechanical engineering, and it's, you know, I take it for granted, but I can kind of see the different layers of house renovations, and I've got this like visual mm-hmm. mind. I can hand draw my own blueprints when I need to, mm-hmm. So I can look at plans or prints, you know, to some level and kind of know what I'm looking at, or just a level of design. I'm not an architect, but certainly if you're flipping houses or if you're building or doing new development, a lot of the creativity, a lot of the layout, a lot of the strategy of the build comes from the mind of the person who's kind of directing the operation. It's not the contractor who designs kitchen. It's not even all the way. Like an architect, you can't just hand over the piece of land and say, okay, draw it. You actually have a lot of input and a lot of decisions as, you know, the developer and the captain of the ship when you're building, or even when you're renovating or turning units over. You got to be the one making the decisions. And like the person who's operating the deals, the background, it's very telling for me, and I'm sure you too, because you have a podcast, it's very telling if you spot these, like, you know, histories of people who came up and are now doing what we're doing, whether that's multifamily investment syndications or whether that's, you know, real estate, single family, or build $1 million homes. But it's, you know, it's very telling to see the history that leads up to the current moment. So let's shift gears real quick here. Tell me about your most exciting or most challenging deal since we talked in 2018. So in the last 2-3 years, what's the one that you're like, you know, either you lost the most sleep about this one, or maybe you were the most excited, you know, this thing finally went to settlement, or we finally got our certificate of occupancy after all this work. Which deal is that, Reed?
That's a good question. Look, I'm pretty excited to say that we're getting the two assets we're selling right now. They've been great deals for us, very good deals, but have also been, I'm excited to see, to go full circle, right? You don't ever trust yourself until you've got that run on the board, you know, if that makes sense. You know, you're being tested against, or what's your track record? Well, I've got all these deals and I'm paying preferred returns and I'm hitting all the, okay, well, but have you exited? Well, no, I haven't. And that's sort of been like, you know, so I'm excited about that. I'm excited to show the investors who put trust in us to invest alongside of us that we're a good steward of their money. We've taken it seriously. You know, even to this day, I don't take a salary on my business. I eat when we close deals, and you know, the money from asset management actually goes to keep the lights on, you know, in terms of paying asset managers and analysts and keeping office space. So I'm very still much an entrepreneur in that, you know, I eat what I kill. But I also take very seriously my job of making sure people have trusted. I am the younger generation. I don't have gray hair, and people trust me with their money. And I'm glad that I can return it with a smile on my face and know that I've given it my all and they've got a good return on top of it. That sort of sends, you know, that's what we've got in this business to do. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's sort of what's sort of not keeping me up at night, but that's what is making me most excited right now, because I know from there, the sort of the snowball is hurtling down the hill, because it's going to pick up more and more momentum because people want to start investing again. They're going to talk to their friends, and it's just going to keep getting more and more traction. So that's pretty exciting for me.
Yeah, it is. And congratulations for the exits must look like the finish line of a marathon. And I can relate in a shorter timeline. So when we're flipping a house, right, we're borrowing $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, whatever it is. We're doing $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $100,000 worth of construction, whatever it is. And we're on, we don't have the, you know, the along the way cash flow. So it's not just a long-term thing. It's a complete speculative investment. And all the house flippers are nodding our head. Yeah, of course. Real estate investors. But man, it's like, I don't know. Even to this day, we did 283 houses in 2020. We've done like 30 or something.
Wow.
Like certain ones, I don't sweat at all. Certain ones, I'm like, feeling the pressure at all times. And we've owned them. We've owned one that's going to close for like a year and a half. We had a lawsuit. Wow. Everything went wrong. We're going to lose like $100,000 on this thing. And like to see that one get to the finish line and then gone. And like even early on in the in my career where it was like those first couple flips, it's like it felt like an eternity to go 3 months of construction, month and a half on the market. I mean, I'm a motivated seller by the time that thing comes around. And, you know, like the first off, hey, take it. Come on, it's sold. It's like 6 days on market, you know. But I can relate to that and then kind of seeing the exit. And I think that's probably why I personally – don't do the syndications and put together, you know, my own apartment deals. And like, I gravitate toward owning that, like a building I told you about, the smaller portfolio on my own, because I don't have the pressure that's applied by having the investors who entrusted me with the money on those. So there's no need for me to sell it. I can kind of sort of leave it out of sight, out of mind, and I can, you know, sell it if I need to or not sell it, but there's no pressure for me operating and owning, you know, my own personal portfolio, like I just heard you describe. It's like these investors are kind of looking for the money. You know what I mean? So a certain amount of freedom, but maybe I don't got the upside there as well. You know,
you're saying all the right stuff. Like that's the point of going in and doing other people's, you know, using other people's money is to grow my own nest egg to eventually one day have a 200, 300 unit property by myself, right? But I also know that being a steward of other people's money, I am more on top of it than it would be if it was my own deal. You know what I mean? You know, like if it was just Reed Goosen's own 200 deal, it's operating with some other people's money. I'm like, no, I need to know everything that's going on because I've got 150 investors who are sweating on me, making sure that I do my job as a sales is going to do. So it helps you rise to the occasion and helps you up level your game. And something that I, you know, very grateful to have this experience. And in the beginning, it was very daunting to take on money like that. But over time, you build that track record, you build that trust, you build that transparency, and things will go wrong, right? You mentioned a lawsuit. I remember flipping my first house and my dad was my investor and I lost a bunch of money because I had to make him whole and I had to give him a return on his money, right? I had issues with my GC as well. We just had COVID. You know, we had to tell investors through COVID, we're going to have to pause distributions. You know, like the market will throw issues at you every single time. It's making sure that you're down, you've got your feet on the ground and your investors know that you have their back and you're going to do everything in your power to make sure that you can navigate these uncertain times. And that's exactly what we do. And you can't sweat that, oh, I wish I could have done this better. Or sorry, no, I wish COVID didn't happen or I wish the snow didn't happen. It's like, that's what happens. Like things are going to, you know, excuse my language, shit's going to happen and you have to navigate through it. That's your job. And that's your job as a syndicator to make sure that you are steering the ship in the right direction. And I can stand here today to say that we have come through COVID pretty much, you know, knock on wood, unscathed. You know, there's a little bit of delinquency issues, but that was the biggest sort of stripes on my shoulder is coming through COVID, you know, as good as we have done. And that's a credit to my team. That's a credit to everyone who's pulled forward. And we've had some issues throughout it, don't get me wrong. But it helps you put the hairs on your chest and, you know, helps you know that you've got the mindset to push through uncertain times and challenging times to come out the other side and you know, not lose people's money. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's ironic that you describe it that way. I mean, it's like, oh yeah, things are going to come up in any market. No, Reed, there was not much that came up from, 2012 to like 2019. Like it was so flat in the stock market. There was like no major issues. There was no, like the mortgage crisis was very media driven and a lot of people lost their homes. But the uncertainty that came along with COVID was this like unique, holy crap, like I might even catch this thing and die. Like it was like really uncertain. And like, thank God it didn't. I mean, at least there are a lot of people who have lost their life, and it is a serious thing with COVID. Yes. But a larger amount of the country was stable enough to continue paying their rent. That's something I didn't anticipate. I thought, oh my gosh, like I am glad I did not do the apartment syndication thing now. Like, man, this is, I'm looking. And like, I had the same issue that you described. Like, there were a couple of people who didn't pay the rent, and I was very proactive with my management company about trying to work out some things. And there's maybe a couple who are like still are about to catch up with their tax return. They found some other work. And I'm happy to say I mean, we had a couple deals we bought where we sort of had some squatter issues, but most of the people took cash for keys to leave. They just abandoned the rental on their own. We have one out of all the deals and all the markets we do, we have one deal literally where they're like squatter's rights, professional tenant, and we're like probably going to fight them for another 9 or 10 months. But like, that's not bad out of a couple hundred houses that we've been in the process of, you know?
And I'll add to that is like, it's also 2008 was very American issue, right? It was very US issue. COVID is a global issue, right? There's rent due in Australia. There's rent due in Mexico. There's rent due in Europe. There's rent due in, you know, Kenya, like it's due all over the world, and people have lost their jobs all over the world. So we're all in the same boat. It wasn't, wasn't just specifically related to America, which then trickled around the world, which happened in 2008. So that is another level set playing field that you sort of have to also understand that you're not in the victim mentality of, oh God, poor us, like, or poor me. It's like, no, this is happening around the world, and we've got to just get up, you know, dust our knees off and do the best we can. And yeah, you're going to have issues with some tenants. You're going to make sure you're going to have you want to keep their best interest at heart, because a lot of people lost their jobs, not from any faults of their own, but from the fact that the place is shut down. Like, and you sort of have to come with a little bit of sympathy, coupled with, you know, the lessons learned from 2008, stimulus checks were a lot more quicker this time around than they were last time around. So that also helps, and that also gives confidence in the market. And then you've got other things like, you know, multifamily. Yes, renters. Some renters have become professional squatters, but compare that to retail, or compare that to hotel or hospitality. Multifamily on the commercial side is looking pretty darn good, and is fared a lot better than some other places that haven't even opened yet. So like, overall, and that goes back to the point we were saying earlier, is the compression in cap rates and why things are so frothy is because of how well multifamily in general has sailed through COVID. Because everyone, to your point, everyone thought, oh gosh, as we did in Lender March, all right, here it comes. You know, we're going to have 50% of our 2,500 units just not pay. You're like, we're calling the banks, get ready, you know, saddle up. And it didn't happen, you know, again, which is good. So I go back to just, you know, not being the pity party, understanding it's a global issue and trying to sort of lead with people first mentality. And I think that, you know, for us at least, we came through relatively unscathed, and I'm proud to look back and say, yeah, we did come through, and we earned our stripes for it. So yeah.
I mean, and we're talking about money. Money's a renewable resource. Like, a lot of people lost their lives here. A lot of people lost family 100%. Members. I mean, yes. You know, it's
they
like
couldn't be there at their funeral.
Unbelievable.
Someone goes off to the hospital, they're dying. It's like, sorry, you can't come in. Like, that's just it's shattering. It's crushing. It's soul crushing. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So let's shift gears again. I thought I saw your Instagram post, and there was new construction going on there. I thought it was a Texas deal, and you had mentioned entitling land. So like, entitling land and doing zoning, I would imagine from people who taught me the business, there were people who would describe putting a piece of land under contract, taking it through the entitlement process, and then selling the contract, the package deal on the flip side, and making like a nice chunk of money. And they probably have $100,000 in soft costs there, attorney fees, architects, et cetera. So it's not a zero risk kind of a proposition. I'm curious, have you done some entitlement of land? Have you built some new construction with multifamily? What did the process look like in the specifics of that deal where you had to like add capital and begin taking layers of risk?
Yes, it's done. So my background in structural engineering, I actually quit engineering in 2012 and moved over to the development side, and there's a picture, if you can see back just underneath here, is nice. The first deal I ever built I was known as rep for a developer here in Los Angeles, but that was my job, entitling dirt for this developer and building high-end multifamily in Long Beach, California. So I had a lot of experience with that. The specific deal you're talking about on Instagram, which I think was called the Monroe, we actually had to walk away from that deal. Were going to come, it was an OZ deal. And we were going to step in opportunity zone, for those people who don't know what OZ means, step in as a developer. So we had to sort of come in before the end of that value was added so we could get the OZ gains. And COVID hit, right? And we wanted to buy it at 217K a door. It was a brand new wrap product deal. We thought we had it all boxed in. And then COVID hit, and lease up risk went from a 24-month issue to a 12-month issue to a 24-month issue, which changed the returns completely. Hmm. And looking back on it, we should have just probably done the deal, because at 217K a door, I know where construction costs are going today, and you won't be able to build it for 217K a door anymore. 3 miles from downtown Austin, in an OZ, an opportunity zone. Like, you know, again, Andrew and I, my business, but we lost 250 Gs on that deal.
Wow. Okay?
But a lesson learned, and we did the right thing by investors and say, look, we can't promise you the same returns we thought we were going to promise you. Things have changed. Insurance has gone up, taxes have gone up, leasing has changed. And through our due diligence, we've decided to walk away. Hard pill to swallow. But again, we've come out the other side, and we've done the right thing by investors, and it was our dollars at risk. Back to your original question, about entitling, yeah, the entitlement game is really, really challenging, because you're at whim of the city, right? And when you're doing large scale projects, they can take 12 months, 24 months, 36 months, depending if you're doing a zoning change, and that can cost you holding costs, particularly if you're trying to get debt on the dirt. And you've got to sponsor or support all the soft costs. And actually, soft costs can be quite expensive. You're getting architects through planning, and then through public comment, and then through the entitlement stage, and then through, you know, you have all these consultants to feed. So when you're not earning cash flow from that, you better have a lot of money in your bank to keep it afloat. Now, some cities are better at approving and quicker than approving, but it just depends on where you want to build. So the for rent product in Austin, Texas can take 2 years to get approved in the city of Austin. It takes a long time. It's like Los Angeles. It's like New York. It takes a long time. And you have to understand that. But a lot of people make a ton of money just entitling dirt, and they do it smart by only going hard with their money until they've got the planning commission on board. And that's sort of the 50% of the total nut along the way. So once you don't have any money up front, you've got and you just get through the planning commission, and then you go hard with your money on the dirt, and then you've taken a lot of risk off the table. I know a lot of people who do that, and then they just turn around and sell the dirt back to another developer because they've taken the risk is out of the deal for them at that point. They're just going to go to get to a shovel-ready permit, and they're off to the races. So it depends. It's horses for courses. It's how much risk you want to, you know, how close to the sun do you want to fly? And really, you know, if you can understand navigating your local municipality, because that's the key. That was my job for my developer in Long Beach, was navigating the city effectively through all the red tape to get a 200 or 300 unit podium-style project, out of the ground, and it takes some time. So, yeah.
What kind of money do you think, if you had to guess? I mean, obviously, I'm not going to say, hey, Reed, you're hired, but like the soft costs on a 200 or 300 unit development entitlement piece with the architect, you know, zoning attorney, the whole thing to get it to the point of the shovel already.
Even if I was comparing it to, say, you know, I'm talking tier one markets, I'm talking Austin. Austin's now a tier one market. If I was doing a downtown Austin project, it'd be similar to LA. I think you're looking at least $1.5 million, like in terms of like that's, you know, that's all your fees as well, to apply the application fees to apply for zoning. The city ain't looking at it for free. They're going to say, yeah, but we'll look at it, cough up $200,000. And then you got $200,000 an architect, you got $400,000 a civil engineer, like all these. And this is to get all the way through from schematic design all the way through to design development, which is a level of project and construction documentation. That's a level of details in your drawings that you need to show local municipalities to say, yes, we think you aren't a Yahoo and going to build some wacky job. and you say what you're going to do, and here's your drawings to prove it. That's essentially what you're pleading your case. And that can take 12 months, it can take 3 years. So again, depends on when you get caught up in the process. So over that period of 3 years, or 2 or 3 years, it could take, yeah, between $1 million to $1.5 million for a 300 unit project for sure.
Yeah, it's wild. I mean, I did it the same small little building. It was an 8 unit when I bought it. It was 10 units, two were illegal. I had to go through the Chicago zoning process. Luckily, I had an attorney who was really solid, well-known. And there was like this kind of handshake thing with the aldermen that they all, you know, the lawyers. So they were all plugged in. It was a very political process that went my way. And then after that, it was a zoning board of appeals for the parking issue. Like one thing after another, I did not realize how much work I was going to have to go through. I wouldn't have built the extra 2 units. It's just like, I haven't even broken ground on the 2 units yet. But it was interesting. The attorney who represented me represented another developer who's doing the Treasure Island grocery store. I don't know his name here in Chicago, but it was like a $65 million development, 90, 100 units, something like that. And
wow.
His sounded a lot more exciting. I said, well, how much would that be? And he's like, yeah, I mean, you might spend, you know, $150,000 to $200,000 just in the attorney. Like we didn't have the architect there. but it was a very, it has been and still is. I think my permit is issued yesterday. I paid for the fee. Yeah, thank you. We'll see about building those extra couple of units. But it's a process that I think has value in certain type of deals at some point. It's not like I'm going to go off and be the, you know, the entitlement guy. We're very successful in single family, but...
But you've learned the process, that the ropes that you're describing just there. And for anyone listening out there who wants to do entitlements, do exactly what you do. Start small. Like find a single family lot that you can put a duplex on, and just go through the process of putting an extra unit on there. Like just start really, really small. And you want to start with what's called by right. So it's zoned, you know, your single family lot might be you by right, by the law, you can add an extra dwelling on it, and you don't have to go through the hoops of zoning change. When you're changing a zone, that is when it just like, oh gosh, that can take you 3 years depending on the municipality. So yeah, it's exciting stuff.
Yeah, it really was. Are there any books that listeners or I could check out that have to do with entitlement, development, or anything like that? Or
I have not come across a lot. It's purely through just education, because again, each city is different, right? Each city has a political sway and how they want their urban core to look, and are they investing in their urban core? Do they want to attract developers? Do they not want to attract developers? So it really, really does come down to get the people that you just mentioned before, those politically connected, not politicians, lawyers, and a lot of local architects, you know, talk to them. The thing that I actually found really interesting here in the United States, I can walk into Los Angeles City Council, and if I've got a piece of land, I can go up to the counter before COVID and ask them questions like, hey, I'm thinking about doing, you know, a 3 unit on here. Can you give me just your 2 cents on can I even do this legally? And they will more than happily give you some their advice. In Australia, that wouldn't happen at all. So there are some ways, and I know they do that in New York as well. So, and I've done some stuff in Philly that I'm pretty sure you can sort of have a chat with one of the local planning planners that can say, yeah, I think you know you can do that. It's in line with what we want to build, and it's in line with the zoning, and there's no conditions on that piece of land to say that you can't build a certain height over 85 feet or whatever it is. So all these things go into it, and it's what's called a specific plan for a certain municipality, and most municipalities will have what's called a specific plan of how they want their city to grow, but that is very dictated, influenced by the politics behind it. So there is no just book to say, this is how you entitle dirt, because it's different in Chicago. It's different in, you know, LA. It's different in New York, because the zoning is all different. It's got different classes, and how you jump from one zone to another is also really, really difficult. And here in California, we have the Coastal Commission. Like, so if you're within 100 feet of the beach, you've got to go through another layer of Coastal Commission for environmental purposes. So there's just different layers there that you can't just say in one handy little book, here you go.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense. And so you mentioned they won't do that in Australia. And if people did not figure that out from the previous episode that we did, where we talked about, your background, but you also have the Invest in the US podcast, right? And so your perspective coming from, you know, halfway around the world and with this kind of global thing, you run that show. And I am curious, right? Little plug for the show. People can go check it out there. You have a a bit of a business format. So it's like investing in some other businesses might be some of the topic, not just investing in U.S. real estate. At least that were a couple of the topics I saw. But I'm curious, were the biggest revelations, highlights, surprises, things that you learned from guests on your own show that you're like, wow, this is, you know, great. I'm glad I was the host of the show to even have this conversation.
Well, you know, as being a podcast host, you know, I started this thing investing in the US 5 years ago. I'm coming to 250 episodes, so 50, you know, one a week. But the thing is, it's like, you, when I started the show, it was just about the benefits of investing here in US real estate. And after doing so many episodes, you can only talk so much about real estate. You know, there's only so many topics before it just, oh, I've heard the tax advice, we've heard this, we've heard that, you know. So I changed the name just to investing in the US. And because there's so many other awesome founders and entrepreneurs who are here who are creating incredible companies. And I think the real big eye-opener for me was is the ecosystem within a business. So, and when I say business, it could be a single family flipper like yourself, and but you've built the construction management, you've built the property management, you've built it all in-house, and that feeds off one another. And that's really what I think starts to create wealth for entrepreneurs, particularly real estate investors. On my side of the fence as well, with the multi side, you know, there's obviously buying multi, which is great because it's a business in itself, but you could have the property management. If you have 1,000 units or 2,000 units, yeah, maybe go start a property management company. You know, you can make a bit of money out of that. Go start a construction management company. Maybe I was looking at a lot of people are starting to build these internet packages on site, and they're property owners. They own 10,000 units because they can do it on their guinea pig as their own portfolio. So the things that I've learned is that talking to other smart people who are way smarter than I am, is just the different ways that you can, you know, build Humpty Dumpty back together again. It's so many people have different takes on it. And that's what I think has been the cool thing about jumping on podcast. And you can hear the energy that I bring, that I try to bring at least, is that I really get my juices flow when I'm talking to other people on that same wavelength, because sometimes entrepreneurship can be a little lonely. And that's what's been the greatest thing that's come out of my show, is opening doors to people like yourself, mate, like talking to other incredible people who are out doing awesome things, and I get to hear their story and I get to share in the experience and the journey along the way. So I don't know if that answered the question, but it's a holistic approach of how I've really enjoyed the podcast. And I actually don't make any money off my podcast, you know, because I just do it because it opens doors. And the doors that it's opened over the last 5 years, I can't put an ROI on that. You know, the investors that I've been introduced to, I'm sure you're in the same boat. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, even the conversations themselves with a variety of guests who may not even remotely look like it's some kind of a match to single family house flipping, there's takeaways from that. I think it was, if I'm not mistaken, the fast food industry stole the drive-through from a bank, I believe is how the story went down. So it was like, here's this, you know, restaurant owner, and he like looks at the bank and they have the drive-through, and then he puts it into the drive-through window, and like, bang, all of a sudden this is like, this defines fast food. So I'm always kind of looking out for the drive-through window type of an idea. So whether it's the psychology of the investor of a multifamily syndication operator, or even the passive investor in that syndication, there's something in the conversation way they think that might apply for me. And it's like, I don't know, you know, I've had, I don't know, 183 of these conversations, and like, it's all right there for someone to go through. And like, literally you could just like see how the conversation developed over the years, you know. It's the same. We don't make any money from the podcast, and I don't even do it for, and like, we've got investors who participate in our deals single family, but we don't really have like a whole lot of that going on. We're kind of self-funded at this point on almost all the projects that we have. We're in a really good position, but the knowledge, I couldn't put a price on the ideas. The drive-through windows that I put into my business, there's no way that I could put a price on that, you know?
I love that. It's nearly like a mentor, right? It acts as a mentor to me, and you keep learning and you keep being curious. And I think that's the challenging part that I love doing this podcast. So,
absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. So any trends or forecasts on what's coming down the pike? It could be product, it could be something about the economy, but like, if you look in your crystal ball, Reed, what do you see?
I see, Look, I think insurance is definitely going to go through the roof. I think it's continuing to go up and up and up. Cap rates are going to probably stay where they are until the Fed starts increasing rates. I do think the short term is that the Feds are going to keep it relatively low as we come out of this pandemic, because they want to keep stimulating the economy. So I don't think it's going to be a Band-Aid ripped off that we're going to go up, 25 basis points every quarter for the next 2 years. I think it's going to be a more a slow and steady increase over the next 2 or 3 years. But for me personally, when money's cheap, cap rates are low, I do think we'll come back to, cap rates will start to expand again. And I think you'll need to underwrite from the multifamily side an expansion in your cap rates upon exit. But I think then also looking at other costs, the insurance costs are really going to play a massive role in how we go about buying deals. And I think global warming will have a massive impact on us as multifamily investors and our portfolios and how we can afford to underwrite. I remember going to Texas, 6-7 years ago, and underwriting deals at $250 a door for insurance. It's now $500 a door. I know that's cheap compared to some of the coastal markets, but that's only happened in the last 5 or 6 years. What's going to happen another 5 or 6 years? It's going to go up even more. So property taxes are going up in Texas. So all these things means that my P&L keeps getting squeezed and I need to be smarter. How do I go out and adapt? Okay, what does the city need? Well, the city needs affordable housing. Well, maybe I can go get some tax credits by doing some affordable housing stuff. Let's start having a conversation around that. So it's thinking a little bit differently. But overall, I do think it ain't getting any cheaper doing multifamily in this day and age. So I think the secret's out and every man and their dog seem to be in multifamily right now.
Yeah. And I wonder how long it's felt like that. My parents thought the taxes were much higher from 10 years ago before that. It's just like an unbearable trend. Any final words of wisdom as we get to the wrap up here on the show?
No, mate. I think the other thing would probably just be watch out for inflation. I think there's going to be a little bit of that coming around the corner with all this lending, quantitative easing. So there will be some inflationary effects that will impact us as real estate investors. So, but that only means that having your money in hard assets is only the better for that. So we're in the right space to be in.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess that's the saving grace, the rising interest, insurance, maybe the rising interest coming down, the lower cap rates, but perhaps the inflation in the rent is what ends up kind of keeping this thing moving as it always has,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Do you want to point listeners who want to get some more Reed Goossens to a website,
sure,
contact them for anything like that?
Yeah. Just simply go to reedgoossens.com. That's reedgoossens.com. I have to spell it out because I've got a lot of double E's, double O's, double S's. And just hit me up there. There's podcasts up there. If you are coming through LA and you want to meet up for a beer or a coffee or lunch and talk shop, you can just drop me a line at info, that's info@reedgoossens.com.
All right, cool. Hey, thanks again for coming back to the show. I had a blast. I got a ton of notes here on the desk. So thank you for coming on the show, Reed.
Mate, my pleasure. Be well and stay warm, as they say now saying in Texas.
Yeah, true enough, huh?
So are you interested in doing deals with no money down? Creative financing? Sounds like a good idea, right? Then you might consider diving deeper into the mortgage note business. The mortgage note business is the creative financing strategy in real estate. First, negotiate no money down deals with sellers. Then find a buyer willing and able to put some money down and continue making payments until the deal is paid off, with a profit for you in between. And one of the things with creative financing is that you can sell properties for much higher prices using creative financing. So here's an example. I bought a package deal a few years ago, and as part of the package, I think there were 5 houses that I really wanted because they were in the right area, and there was a 6th house for $20,000 not in the right area. That house that I had to buy for $20,000 as part of the package, it was worth about $20,000. And I tried selling the house on the market for $20,000, plus or minus, leaving the room for the commission, but to no avail. The house did not sell. So I removed the listing and I wrote a Craigslist ad offering that same house for $45,000. And this time I added creative financing. So the deal sold for a price of $45,000 with $8,500 down and $443 per month for 10 years. So the deal was off my plate collecting payments. Now, if the deal runs all the way through the 10 years, I'll end up with a total of $61,660 on a deal I couldn't sell that I had to buy for $20,000, which amounts to a profit of $41,660. Not a bad deal on a deal that I couldn't even sell to break even, right? So what's the best way to learn about creative financing, no money down deals, and the mortgage note business? Well, you're in luck. My friend Brian Lochner is hosting a full day virtual workshop in a few weeks on exactly that topic. And normally this costs $97 to attend, but as an REI Diamond Show listener, you can attend free when you register at reinoteschool.com. This class is a full day of content, tons of examples of real deals, and of course many of these deals are the crowd favorites. No money down and extracting a nice chunk of cash up front, followed by years of additional payments. So go check the schedule and sign up at reinoteschool.com. And thank you for tuning in to this episode of the REI Diamond Show. Remember to review and subscribe on your podcasting app. Just search REI Diamonds and click subscribe. If you're interested in receiving my weekly Big Idea email, where I provide the most valuable jewel of wisdom discovered during the recording of the most recent episode, you can sign up at reidiamonds.com. Also, at that site, you can access the 186-episode archive with descriptions. Again, that's reidiamonds.com. So in 2020, my house flipping business, Diamond Equity Investments, bought and sold 283 houses. And we've done 53 so far this year. Well, mostly houses. A few were apartment buildings. And we currently have 128 more in our inventory, either under construction or under contract and awaiting close. So here are three ways that you and I can do business. Number one, are you interested in having access to the best real estate deals in your market? In other words, access to deals that you can buy at low enough prices to actually profit after renovating and reselling? If so, go now to accessrealestatedeals.com. Number two, accredited investors who are seeking double-digit returns can sign up for my private mortgage investment opportunity emails at fundrehabdeals.com, and that is for an opportunity to passively participate in my deals. Those 283 houses we did last year were funded in similar fashion. Number three, finally, I am always buying houses that I can flip and occupied apartment buildings with below market rents, so I have a little bit of upside to move the value in the right direction. If you have a deal that fits that description, either in Atlanta, Chicago, or the Philadelphia region, please send me an email with the details. We are at the conclusion, my friend. Next up, we have multifamily syndicator Chris Larson joining us to discuss his quest to build a $100 million multifamily portfolio. Catch you next time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.